This is the regular statewide meeting, Georgia Assembly. My name is Jack Burke. I'm an alcoholic from the Tri-County Group at Rossville. I don't know why they asked me to chair this meeting, except that I'm always so well confused. I usually wind up the meeting by reading the preamble or something real smart like that. So we will open the meeting with a moment's silent meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. 12 steps will be read by Mary C., Metro Area Zone C, Committee Woman.
Hi, everybody. I used to crawl in the bottle. I close my eyes and all your people go away, but you're not doing it tonight. The 12 steps that we in AA try to live by. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except them to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, stopped through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all affairs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. The 12 Traditions, Frank L., committee member from District 7. Frank.
Hi, everybody. My name is Frank Lester, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm real happy to be here tonight. I'm a member of the Macon Group. 12 Traditions. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Thus, problems with money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. Finally, 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personality. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Frank. A couple of comments that he'd like to make at this time, if you'll bear with us, please.
My name is Bob Ross, and I'm an alcoholic. Got two or three announcements, plus. And we have a good plus. First announcement is vital, because I think you've all read in the message we're trying to run our assembly on a basis where everybody can be pleased, and this is hard to do in AA, but to please us, the meeting in the morning begins at 9:30 sharp, and the afternoon session begins at 1 p.m. sharp, and we hope to terminate at 3 p.m. sharp. So all those who are going to cooperate, be here on time, and we'll get your way on time. We've got a lot of business to transact, but we've figured our time schedule, and we know we can get you out on time. One of the announcements given to me is the Atlanta Metro-wide meeting will be held at Peachtree Christian Church Saturday evening, October the 3rd at 8 o'clock. The speaker will be Gene F. from Memphis, Tennessee. Sixth anniversary of the Austell Group will be the following day, Sunday, October the 4th at 2 p.m. It says come and eat with us at 2 o'clock and hear Judge Bill W. from Dublin at 3. The Inside Out Group, which is a group at the Federal Pen in Atlanta, is having their anniversary meeting on Sunday, September the 27th. That's next Sunday afternoon from 1 to 3. I believe the request is that we be at the gate by 12:30 at the latest, so that everybody can go in at the same time. And fortunately, or unfortunately, I would say, at the bottom is a little note. We are sorry to announce that this invitation will be for male AA members only. So you gals that want to go to prison, you can't do it. Ruth F., our delegate from the Al-Anon side of our program, asked me if she might have just about a minute of our time, and we're always happy to share our time with the Al-Anons because they certainly help us a lot. So I'm going to ask Ruth if she'll come up now.
Hi, everybody. I am Ruth, and I'm a grateful Al-Anon. I want to say one thing here, and that is thank you. If there's a complaint, you'll hear it. If we've got a gripe about somebody, you'll hear that too. And lots of times we don't hear the good things, and so I want to say the good things tonight. And that is how deeply we Al-Anons appreciate all your help and support from all you wonderful AAs. This is my last time as I get voted out tomorrow. And then when I was in New York, the going out delegates get to make a report. And in my report, I told them there that Georgia Al-Anon and Georgia Alcoholics Anonymous members have a wonderful relationship. You have helped us in so many ways. When we need a place to meet, you help us find one. At your convention, you give us time for an Al-Anon speaker. And not only that, you let us choose our speaker. It isn't this way in lots of places. And so I can see, having seen these other people, how much ahead of them we are. I told it in New York, and so I thought I just ought to tell you that this is the way it is in Georgia. And so when you go back to your groups at home, would you tell those wonderful men and those wonderful AA women that the Al-Anons of Georgia are deeply grateful. So much for your cooperation, but even more for your friendship. And it's returned double fold with friendship and love. Thanks.
Thank you, thank you. I told you I forgot something. Hi, everybody. Well, I wouldn't expect you to. It's my privilege tonight to introduce to you a man that I'm sure that most of you know. And those that don't know him personally certainly know him by reputation. He's newly elected delegate at large. Somebody said it's finally his time he was at large again. It had him. But we'll pass that up. Anyhow, Jim's been around AA for quite a few years. He's been the most dedicated worker and is deserving of any honors that he might receive. Of course, in AA, your honors are real fine things. Most places you get volunteered to do whatever it is, and when you get volunteered, the people that volunteer you, it's your job. The honor's gone, and it's your job. But Jim has done all this for 19, 20 years, and has enjoyed doing it, I'm sure. I was supposed to ask for announcements here, but I didn't. That's another thing that I messed up, and I'll get those later. But now, I want you to hear what you came here to hear, and that's Jim H.
Thank you, Jack. My name is Jim Hyers, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. Hi. It's real nice to be back in Georgia again. I want to thank Bob and his committee for making this possible for me to be with you this weekend. I was sitting here thinking a while ago, I think the first meeting I attended in this hotel was back in 59 at your convention, I believe. And those of you who were here for the business meeting, you remember some frustrating times that year. In that few times since then, and possibly later on in my story, you'll know why I feel so very, very close to Georgia AA. One reason is you're pretty close to home. I'm right across the Savannah River, but I'm a native of South Carolina, not an Alabamian by birth. You know, when we go back to different places so often, at least the way I feel about it, and tell our stories over and over again, sometimes we even get bored with hearing them ourselves. As a lot of you here tonight have heard my story many, many times, I've got news for you. It hasn't changed any. And God help me, I hope it never changes. I hope that I have changed a little bit, because that's the name of the game in AA, is that we progress a little one day at a time. And if we do make progress, we can't help but change in some respects. And I hope that maybe I have changed just a little bit for the good since you heard me last time. For some of you, that hasn't been very long. It could be very much change in 3 weeks. The big book tells us to share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And trying to talk to an AA group, it further suggests that we tell what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. I think when I said I was an alcoholic, I told you what I was like. You know half of my life already. What happened is one of the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the grace of God as I understand him, and what I'm like now, well, I'll leave that up to you when I get through. I said I was an alcoholic. I think my basic problem is one that not only we in AA all have, but I think everybody in the world has the same problem. We may manifest that problem in different ways. You and I turn to the bottle to manifest our basic problem. But I think mine is the problem of living. And as I look back, I've had it all my life. I still have it. And I must assume at this point that I have it for the remainder of my life. And I think my alcoholism is primarily a symptom of that basic problem. Now, the longer I stay around this program, the further back I can see in my life. Not to try to analyze what happened, but maybe put little pieces together so that I know possibly where I came from. And I remember as a teenager, a rather young teenager, I think I had some serious living problems. And these living problems, as well as I can remember them at that time, were my inabilities to cope with the situation at hand, whatever it might be, whether it's people, places, or circumstances. I couldn't cope with it. I couldn't be a part of life. It seemed like I was always apart from it. And as a teenager, somebody passed a bottle one night. I took a slug. And these problems of living disappeared immediately. I expect some of you had that same reaction to a few drinks during your life. But I remember my thinking that night as I... Jerry's got problems. I remember my thinking that night as I realized these problems of living were disappearing from my life because of that drink. And I thought, this is the answer. Next time that life gets so unbearable and uncomfortable for me, I'll just simply take another drink. And for many, many years, I used alcohol as the answer to the problem of living, and it fulfilled the answer pretty well. Of course, every time I came to after a drink or a drinking night or a drinking weekend, the problems of living had multiplied because I had created some because of my behavior. But I always had the answer at my hand. Take another drink and the problems disappeared. But as years progressed and my alcoholism progressed, the problems got greater and the necessity for the answer became greater. And consequently, I found myself drinking almost continuously. And I did that for a long, long time before you found me. I'll tell you about the first drink, and I'm not going to tell you all of the drinking in between because I think you know the story. I've often said I wish I could make an AA talk and not talk about my drinking. One of these days I'm going to try it. But I want to tell you about the events that led up to my last drink. And believe me, the things I experienced between my first one and my last one were all the things that you experienced in your life. The loneliness, the aloneness, the hurt, the embarrassment that I caused, the desperation of being alone, the degradation that goes along with active alcoholism. All these things I experienced, maybe to not the same extent that you did, maybe more or less, I don't know. But they were part of my life, and I hope I never forget them. Evelyn and myself, a lot of you know Evelyn. We were married in 1943. She's a native of Ohio. We were married in her hometown of Sandusky. I was working for the federal government in Toledo at the time. I was drinking around the clock. She didn't think I had a problem, and I didn't think so either, because I had many more years of drinking after that. We have three beautiful daughters, the most beautiful in the world, and if you don't think the same of yours, you better go back and take another look at them. I think mine are the greatest, and you should think the same of yours. I'll tell you a little more about the daughters. One of them is living in New York. She is a stewardess with United Airlines. And if you fly the friendly skies of the United and see her, you'll also fly the lovely skies of the United. Another daughter is living in Atlanta, and that's another reason I feel close to Georgia. She recently graduated from college and is now living in Atlanta and working there. And the youngest one is a junior at Auburn University. Depends on where I am, whether I brag about Auburn or not. Some places it's not safe. Some places it is. But we are a very happy and close family. Now getting back to my drinking. After Evelyn and herself had lived in California for a few years, we came back to South Carolina. And we were living in Columbia at the time, and I was working with a particular State Department, and I'm too close to state line to tell about everything I did when I was working for the State Department. Some of you might have been over there at the time and maybe still connected with it somehow. But we were living in Columbia, and we had two daughters, Marion and Christine. Mary Jane hadn't been born yet. Evelyn was working to support the girls. Mine was a fairly nice job with a good expense account. And that's the part I'm not going to tell you about because there could be a state auditor around here. But I used it the way a typical alcoholic will. I'll tell you that much, and you can draw your own conclusions. Mine was a traveling job. I traveled the whole state, and I sometimes thought the office thought I was going for a week, and I really wasn't. I was right down the street in a hotel, probably. I remember getting up one morning, and I had thought prior to this time about, well, maybe my drinking is causing some of these problems I'm experiencing. Maybe I'm drinking just a little too much. See, I had experienced, or I remember some of the things that I thought I might be causing or responsible for. And with these in mind, I said, well, I think I'll quit. Now, that's a horrible thought for an alcoholic to have, especially when he doesn't have the answer on how to quit. But every time I thought about not drinking or quitting, I thought about it on a lifetime basis. The only 24-hour program I knew of at that time is trying to plan my drunks, 24 hours in advance or at a time. And when you, I don't know about you, but if you ever had the same thought of quitting alcohol for the rest of your life, that's too long. We can't face that. It's too horrible. And I'd immediately dismiss that thought or get drunk and forget it because I couldn't stand it. And I'd also have other thoughts like, well, next year, or maybe a year after next, I've got to go to a convention or a football game. And I was convinced that you couldn't go to either one of those affairs without having a bottle in the arm. So I put off the quitting until after that event took place. I even might think, well, somebody's going to die next year, and I'll have to go to the funeral, and I'll have to be fortified to face that grief. All kind of rationalization and excuses that were acceptable to me at that time. So I wouldn't even try to slow up on the drinking. But I remember this morning when I got up and I told Evelyn, I said, I'm going to stop drinking. That was the first lie I told that morning. I told her I had thought about stopping, and I couldn't on my own. And I thought I needed help. She suggested I go see a psychiatrist. And it didn't take her long to come up with that answer either. She must have had it on the tip of her tongue for a long time. I looked in the classified section of the telephone book and found one, called him, and got an appointment immediately. Thought I had any sense there was a message here because it's you don't get an appointment with a psychiatrist even back then immediately if they're any good at all. So I went to see the little man. Went in his office, and I don't remember how it looked, but well, I won't say any more. That's why I sat down and started talking to him, and I think I told him a little of the truth of me. Not too much, because at that point in time, I wasn't too anxious to tell the truth about Jim Hires. I didn't think any of you knew it. I was keeping the big secret. Apparently, I told him enough that he realized he had a tiger by the tail. And he said, "Jim, you're an alcoholic." That's the first time I'd ever heard the word. But it was a lot nicer than some things I'd been called. And he says, "I can't help you." And as he was telling me this, he was standing up trying to help me get me to other offices politely but as quickly as possible because he didn't want anything to do with me. And I'm sure that if the little man had known what to suggest at that time, he would have shared it with me, but he didn't, I don't think. All he wanted to do was get me out. That wounded me deeply. I left there and I brooded for a little while and had a few drinks. Felt sorry for myself and I thought, well, I'm not going to let this man whip me. I'm going to find help somewhere. So I called the medical doctor that we still had a charge account with in Columbia. Called him and got an appointment. He thought we were out of the bill. Only reason to see me. But I fooled him. I went in and sat down and told him a little bit about me, not as much as I told the psychiatrist. He interrupted me also. But his interruption was a little different. He started congratulating me for coming to see him. And he went on and on and on. Finally, it came out why he was so happy to see me. He ran a sanitarium for alcoholics on the edge of Columbia. And he was leading up to suggesting that I enter his joint for the cure. At least that's what I understood. He told me if I went there, say 2 weeks, I'd leave a different person. I thought he meant I'd leave there cured. I went home, or rather went to Evelyn's apartment she was renting for me. It wasn't the nicest place in the world, but it was far below what I thought I deserved, but all she had provided. And got ready to go to this jitter joint. My getting ready amounted to putting a pair of trousers in a suitcase. I don't think I took pajamas because I wasn't on very friendly terms with pajamas in those days. I called Evelyn and told her what I was going to do. I was going to make this move and go get cured. And she said, "How are you going to pay for it?" Well, that was the least of my worries. I'd been a paper hanger for a good while. So I went by the liquor store, bought me a few jugs. But I knew this doctor was telling me the truth. Whatever he did, he would do it to me, and I'd leave there and never take another drink. And I wanted to take advantage of this little interlude and drink all I could before I got there. You can imagine the condition I was in when I arrived. I rolled up the steps and rang the doorbell, and they opened the door and rolled me in, took my whiskey, and I found out later what the doctor meant when he said you'd leave there a different man. See, this is a place you could go and drink all you wanted to, not get in trouble. And I got a hunch they sold me a lot of my own whiskey. I had a good time for a few days around there. They serve you a drink whenever you announced that you thought you needed one. And they almost had to put on a special attendant to take care of this one. But you know, I like to stop at times in my life now and look back on the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous as it applies to me. I can't look at your miracle, only you can do that. But I certainly need to look at my miracle quite often. And even long before I went to my first AA meeting, It seems as if the miracle of AA was beginning to happen in my life. It's a beautiful thing when I can sit down and look at how all the little pieces of the jigsaw puzzle of life fell in the proper place at the proper time. And they started in this sanitarium. Because one night, I don't remember how long I'd been there, possibly a week or 10 days, three members of the only group in Columbia at that time came out doing some 12-step work, and I blamed Elvin for this too, because I was sure then that she sent them to see me. But as soon as they got in the front door, they cornered me and started talking, I think. I don't remember too well. And it seemed like they talked for weeks. And I couldn't get rid of them. He couldn't shake these birds. But eventually, well, they had me cornered so I couldn't get my drink at the usual time. And eventually I began to hear a little bit of what they were saying. And I remember one of the guys, and all three of them could be sitting here tonight. I wouldn't know them because I've never seen them since. I don't know whether they told me their names. I'm sure they did, but I don't remember. But wherever they are, if they're still alive, God bless them. I remember one of these guys, along the latter part of this little 12-step work they were doing, said they too were alcoholics. They had a drinking problem, and they joined an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they hadn't had a drink since. I don't know how long since was, but it impressed the heck out of me. It may have been just the day before, but that was a lifetime to me. And then they popped the age-old question, do you want to stop drinking? Well, I thought if I said yeah, they'd leave, and I could get them a drink. So I said, yes, I do. Will you come to a meeting? Well, I thought maybe that would get rid of them if I said yes. And I said, yes. They still didn't leave. I said, when is the next meeting? And they said, Friday night. So Friday was the day I was going to get out of this place. And you know, since I've been around the program and have been able to look at things, there's one thing I've observed. Whenever there's an alcoholic, be he man or woman, shall we say confined in some type of institution or place of confinement, that the day they get out, wherever they are, if they want to go to a meeting that night, there's one for them in that town. There's one for me that night in Columbia. April the 1st, 1949, I gave the good doctor a bad check. Went up to back to Elvin's apartment. But I went by the liquor store on the way. Because these guys had told me that they had joined Alcoholics Anonymous and hadn't had a drink since. I thought, well, they've got the cure. The doctor doesn't have it, but they have. And the difference between my leaving there and my arriving at this hospital was I was drunker when I left. And I think that's what the doctor meant. I'd leave different. I went home and started getting ready for my first AA meeting. And this was around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And in my condition at that time, with my worldly possessions, it didn't take me very long to get ready. But during the process of putting on that other pair of trousers, I called Evelyn. Told her that I was making this great sacrifice. I tried to let her know that I was making it for her. That I was going to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I expected a real warm reaction. And all she said was, oh. See, she had read the big book of the Alcoholics Anonymous. She knew more about AA then than I know now. And she knew that I was a phony. Almost as well as I knew it. So I got ready to go to my meeting. I left right early in the afternoon. The meeting wasn't till 8 o'clock that night. But I had to make a little stop on the way. And I stayed quite a while at this one stop. I got to my first meeting that night. It was a small crowd, maybe 30 or 40. I was loaded. not only with booze, but I was loaded with resentment, hate, self-pity. All the character defects that you and I are so capable of mustering up at opportune time. I walked in by myself, no sponsor. I saw a vacant seat on the front row, so I wanted to be the first ones to get whatever they gave. I imagine it was kind of like that seat right there. I sat down. The ones right next to me got up and moved over. I must have had that sanitarium smell. The speaker got up and, God bless him, his name was Griff. He's dead now. He told my story, I thought. I blamed Evelyn for this. She called these characters and told him, they told him all that I had done, and now he was telling everybody in the meeting. My resentments increased tremendously. I no longer felt sorry for me. I just felt sorry for Evelyn. When I got home, I was going to tell her a few things. As soon as I said amen, I left. Very disappointed because you hadn't done what I expected you to. I had come, I had joined, and you had failed to give me the cure. I thought that's all we had to do in AA, was say, I'm going to join and sit down, and you'd give me something, and I would be cured and never drink again. I'm sure there was a lot of conversation and talk that night about the 12 steps of the recovery program of AA. I didn't hear any of it. I didn't realize that Griff was trying to share with me his experience, strength, and hope in order that I might have a little of what he had found in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was too busy waiting for you to do it for me. And you didn't do it. And I got mad. And I left you as quick as I could and went by the bootleggers. I'll show you. I got home a few days later. And you can imagine the condition I was in. I gave you a second chance. I went back to another meeting. I went in the same condition. I left in the same condition, too. Got home in the same condition. I said, well, even if they didn't do it the first two times, even a dog deserves a third chance. So I went back to the third meeting. Still sitting on the front row, waiting for you to pass it out. Goodness knows you should see that I wanted to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I had joined. I was there. Why don't you give me what you have? I didn't know whether it came in packages, bottles, or in a dish or what. But please give it to me so I can get Evelyn off my back. And you didn't. So I quit you. I resigned. And I wallowed in my misery for a few more weeks. And believe me, the misery after one AA meeting is almost unbearable. And I had a triple dose. I'd been to three meetings. I thought I'd made a great sacrifice. And one night I was feeling particularly sorry for Jim. I had a good case of the old plum disease, you know, poor little old me. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. But I didn't like what I was. I think maybe I could fool part of the people part of the time. But I don't think I could fool Jim at any time because deep down in here I knew what a phony I was. I knew too some of the things that I was causing my loved ones, my family, my friends, my employer. Because he was an alcoholic too. And the things that I could remember, I didn't like. I remember on numerous occasions stumbling home from a prolonged absence. I took the geographical cure in South Carolina just about every week, I think. Stumbling in the front door and seeing a little girl run, hide, because she was afraid of what was coming in. I was our daughter. I didn't like this. But how can you stop doing something you don't like when you don't know how to stop? I'd have given anything in the world for her not to run away from me, but to run towards me. But I didn't know where the answer was. The answer that I've been using to overcome the problem of living was causing me great discomfort at this point in time. I could no longer be comfortable at any place or any time. It's not fun to have hear your wife cry herself to sleep at night. Not because of any physical pain, but because of the emotional, spiritual pain that she was suffering because of an alcoholic husband. It's not fun to see the look in the eyes of the people that love you dearly, and you know that you're causing that look. And these things I didn't like. And I'd have given anything in the world if I could have stopped it, but I didn't know how. And I remember must have taken somewhat of an inventory that night. Not exactly the kind we speak of in the fourth step, but we've got to start somewhere. And maybe this is another piece of the jigsaw puzzle of life that is falling in place for me. But I remember that night I thought, well, you went to a minister once before you went to see the psychiatrist. You talked to him. You told him a little about you. And I remember so clearly his advice, Jim, use your willpower and don't drink so much. Well, that was the only thing he knew to tell me at the time, because he didn't know any more about the problem of alcoholism. But I rationalized that in thinking, well, organized religion has failed me. They can't help me. And a member of the psychiatrist, all he did was get me out of his office as quickly as possible. Psychiatric profession couldn't help me. And the doctor that owned a jitter joint, well, all he did was get me drunk. I said, well, the medical profession has no answer for your problem, Jim. And then I thought about AA. I'd given you 3 chances and you'd failed. And my rationalization was that night, AA has failed you. They can't help you. So what they're left to do? Well, hating me the way I did, partially aware of what I was doing to other people, I decided the best thing to do is take me out of the way. Now, I was a coward then, and I'm a little bit of a coward about some things now. I didn't like pain. Don't like anything messy. I tried self-destruction a couple of times. You know, always the grandstand play. I thought, well, this time I'll get them. I was not a bloated drunk. I weighed about 125 or 30 pounds then. Physically, I was pretty well gone. I said, I'll drink myself to death. You're way ahead of me, aren't you? I think I made this decision for 2 reasons. One, I really wanted to get rid of me. I wanted to enjoy it while I was doing it. So I set out this night in May of 1949 to do just that. Oh, I'd experienced blackouts galore. And I knew that all I had to do was have a few drinks and I'd be oblivious to you and to me and the world round about me. And I wanted to be oblivious. I wanted to live in oblivion. And for the next 14 or 15 months, I did just that. I think if it's possible for a human being to experience hell on earth, the last few months just prior to surrendering to AA, for the active alcoholic, is hell on earth. It was for me, and I don't think there are words in anybody's vocabulary that can adequately describe what we go through. Certainly, I can't tell you what I went through. But I remember coming to occasionally during those 14 months. Not sober, no. But just coming to and seeing that I was still alive. Disappointed that I was. Maybe I'd get a paper. I wouldn't buy it. I'd steal it. Not to find out what was going on in the world. No, I could care less. But maybe to find out what month it was. Or maybe what state I was in. I traveled your state. I traveled North Carolina, South Carolina, and maybe a lot of others that I don't remember. I may have even hit Huntsville. Who knows? Then I'd take a drink and be oblivious to the world. And one day, another piece of the miracle of AA. While luxuriating with the people around Myrtle Beach, except they had a bed to sleep in and I was using the beach, I was picked up by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a sister of mine who lived in Atlanta at the time. They brought me to Atlanta, and I was to talk to another psychiatrist. And if I talked right and he was in the right mood, maybe he'd admit me to his hospital. I was perfectly willing to do whatever was necessary at that time to. I don't know whether I wanted to get sober, no. I'm not sure that I did. But I think that if I could have, I think I thought that if I could get admitted to this hospital, there'd be a certain amount of security. I knew I couldn't drink in there. And I also felt that maybe the sheriff could get me in there. See, I had pretty well plastered two or three states for some bad paper. A few other things committed in between. I was ready to run and find a place of security and safety. I talked to this little psychiatrist and I told him more about me than I'd ever told anybody. It just kind of rolled out. And he knew about alcoholism. He knew the alcoholic and he knew Alcoholics Anonymous. He admitted me to his hospital. It was a VA hospital. I had a private room. See, this is the maximum security psychiatric ward, right where I deserve to be. And the kind of private rooms you have in a place like that are not most luxurious. I had a bed, I had a chair, and I had a window. This is in July of 1950. That window had bars, and I got a striped suntan that summer. They served me my meals in the room. They were afraid to let me out. They shaved me because they were afraid to trust me with anything that might be used as a means of self-destruction. They lit my cigarettes for me whenever they'd give me one and sit there and watch me smoke it. See, I could be trusted completely. But you know, all these things I think are necessary. And so far as I was concerned, for me to eventually get to the place where I could accept what you had to offer. But I had more suffering to do. Much more. After I'd been on this maximum security ward for 7 weeks, and this little doctor used to make me mad. Oh, God, he'd make me mad every day. But he knew how to do it nicely. He'd come along on his morning rounds, he'd look at me and say, and that's all. I could never say good morning, go to hell, anything else to him. He was gone before I had a chance. But after 7 weeks, he called me in his office one day and he said, sit down, Jim, I want to talk to you. Handed me a piece of paper. I looked at it and what I saw on it, I didn't recognize. He says, I see you don't know what that is. I said, no. He said, well, that address on that piece of paper is the downtown group of Alcoholics Anonymous, 522 and a half West Peachtree Street. He says, tonight I want you to catch a bus. I want you to go down there and make up your mind what you want to do. He said, now here's $5. Part of that's for bus fare. But the rest of it is for a pint of whiskey if you want to buy it, because there's a liquor store right across the street. He says, you're going by yourself, and you're going to make the decision which side of the street you're going to walk on from now on. Well, he gave me my clothes that afternoon, and I got on that bus. And those of you who are familiar with 522 and a half, you know that wasn't located on the corner. If I remember correctly, in those days, bus stops were on the corner. But that night, that very smart bus driver pulled right up in front of 522 and a half and turned around and looked at me. I still had the smell. I got off and went to that door, and stairs were quite high. I looked at them, and it looked like you reach all the way to the stars. I knew I couldn't climb those steps. They were too steep for me. They were too long. I looked across the street, and that neon sign was blinking beautifully. Nobody came along. Everybody was going to the meeting must have been already there. But there I was by myself, just as the doctor ordered. I think subconsciously I wanted to go across the street. Spend that $5. But I think in my heart I knew that if you took one more drink, Jim, you were a goner. And that doctor had told me that if I go across the street, as far as he's concerned, I could go to hell. I would have. I looked at those stairs and those steps. Some of you remember how steep they were and how long. And I realized, I think for the first time in my life, partially, my powerlessness, helplessness. But all of a sudden, I found myself climbing those steps one at a time. I went in and sat down. The speaker got up and told his story. He didn't tell mine this time. The guy was from Chattanooga. And as he told his story, all of a sudden it began to make a little bit of sense to me. The answers to the problem of living that I was looking for at the bottom of the bottle weren't there. All the answers to any problem that I'd ever have for the rest of my life were contained in 12 suggested steps of recovery. And don't get uneasy, I'm not going through them one by one. And I thought to myself that night, I wish those people in Columbia would come over here and get some of this good Georgia AA. I think for the first time in my life, I was listening just a little bit. Just enough to hear a little of what you had to say, but enough for me to want more of it. I left that meeting that night quite happy. The secretary and her husband took me back to the hospital. The secretary of the group that night was named Ellen R., and her husband Jim. Took me back to the hospital that night. First mistake I made after I got there, I woke up the psychiatrist and started telling him about AA, and he didn't appreciate that at that time of night. He said, go to bed, we'll talk about it tomorrow, and we did. I stayed there for 10 more weeks and went to meetings every night, every week, and didn't go across the street. I climbed those steps every week. And a miracle was happening, something strange, I didn't know what it was. I wasn't drinking, yet I had an opportunity to get a drink if I wanted it. I was beginning to feel good and see things and hear things, smell things. And I thought, well, old Jim, old boy, you left home in July to go to the dry cleaners. Here it is, November. You haven't gotten home yet. You walked off of a job. I'm sure it's not available for you. Maybe you better try to get one. Went back to the Civil Service Commission and got a job in Huntsville. I never heard of the place, but I took it. Went to Huntsville in December of 1950 on borrowed money. Got there, and through a miracle of many things and some very compassionate and loving friends, I was able to get Evelyn and the girls moved to Huntsville in December of that year. Mostly Evelyn's money and very little of mine. But Gene and the three girls moved from Columbia to Huntsville on a Greyhound bus and didn't have to check anything. Because I'd gotten rid of everything that could be moved and was worth anything. I'd hock it. They arrived in Huntsville at 4 o'clock the morning of December 22nd, and old Dad was drunk. He was celebrating Christmas early. We had a dry Christmas that year, miserable for all of them, I'm sure, including me. See, when I got to Huntsville, I was too busy getting adjusted to a new area to go to AA. I had forgotten what you told me in Atlanta. Or maybe I hadn't listened as well as I thought I had. But shortly after the first year, I started going to AA in Huntsville, and it was a very small group, from 6 to 10 members twice a week. But you know, it doesn't make any difference how much quantity we have in AA. It's the quality, I think. They shared their experience, strength, and hope with me in love and great abundance. But I came up with another excuse that was acceptable to me. And I think as long as I had excuses or reasons for not doing what you suggested and were acceptable to me, I was in for another drunk. I had to work overtime. I couldn't go to your own meetings. And you know what happened? I did. In April of that year, this is 1951, I took what I hope is my last drink. And as I was taking that drink that afternoon, a thought ran through my mind. Jim, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. Nothing like a spiritual experience to compare it to anything close to what anybody's had a spiritual experience that AA has had. But it's just a simple, plain thought. You never have to drink again if you don't want to. Somehow, somewhere along the line, the message you were trying to share with me had gotten through. I knew there was an answer. And I knew where it was. I knew it was an AA. And the next Tuesday night, I didn't have to work overtime. They didn't need me, and I didn't need them. I went back to AA. This time I didn't sit on the front row. I sat kind of middle ways. But I heard that handful of people in Huntsville saying things that night that I hadn't heard them say before. I'm sure they'd said them many times, but I hadn't been very receptive. And I thought to myself that night as I went to that meeting, and I guess all of us have our own ways of praying and own ways of expressing things we want desperately. So I thought maybe I had run out of chances, and who knows when we will. But then I thought maybe I'd used up my last one, and I thought going up those old rickety stairs that night, this was an upstairs job too, please God, just give me one more chance. One more chance to get a little bit of what I saw, felt, heard in AA before. If you give me this one chance, God, I'll try not to mess up again. I didn't promise him I wouldn't, but I'll try not to. And that's the story of my life since that April day in 1951. I've been trying not to. I've come pretty close on many occasions. Because you see, I'm still a human being and I'm still an alcoholic. And I'm still subject to making errors quite often. I still like to get in the driver's seat and run things. I need it early in the morning when I try to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And I do a pretty good job for a little while. And somewhere during the day, if somebody does something I don't like, and I've had to get back in the driver's seat. And things don't go so good when I'm sitting up there. But you know, as we listen and learn in AA on how to live with this problem, We hear little things that we can take home with us, and we may not ever remember them again for a long time. Until some critical thing comes along that maybe threatens our sobriety and our peace of mind and our serenity. And we reach back in our bag of AA that you have given me. And I pull out this little thing that somebody said one night. And I'm able to overcome this critical situation that might be facing me. Because during these 19 or so years, you, the members of AA, have shared with me in great abundances at all times everything you knew to give away. What you've given me is life itself. You've given me a way of life, not sobriety so much, but a way of life that is incomparable with anything else on this earth. And you and AA know what I'm talking about. I can tell you many of the things that I have had problems with since coming to this program. I could keep you here all night telling you the blessings of living the AA way of life. But I think you know them. Because I can see from where I'm standing that you know them, and I can feel it. I've still got the problem of living. Maybe the impact is not quite as great now as it was some 20 or 25 years ago. Maybe it's not quite as big as it was at the time I took my first drink. But I still have a problem with living. But I'm no longer apart from, I'm a part of life. Because you gave me a way of life that I could use in my own way to the best of my ability one day at a time. And this way of life you have given me, I've discovered to utter amazement, is so great and so rich with everything necessary to live comfortably, that I can find an answer to any problem, and I mean any problem, that might come up in my day-to-day living. I just want to tell you this, and then I'm going to close. I try to live my eighth day something like this now. I like to get up early in the morning so I can have a little quiet time with just me. I put on that pot of coffee, and when it's ready, I sit down with my cup of coffee, my God, and me. I try to make a contract at that time that I can live by if I try hard enough. It's not impossible for me. But I don't think there's a day going by that I have complied completely with this contract, and I doubt if I ever will. I try to have a conscious contact with God at this time of the day. Because I think it's necessary that you and I start the day off right if we want to be comfortable during that day. I say to God, please don't let me take a drink today. Well, if I try to do God's will, I won't take a drink. I don't think it's God's will that you and I ever take a drink at any time. I don't think He intended us to take a drink when He put us here on earth as His children. So I don't pray that anymore in the mornings. My contract goes something like this. Now, God, I will do my best to turn my will and my life over to care of you as I understand you. Just what you suggest in the 11th step. And please, God, give me the strength, the courage, the wisdom, and whatever is necessary to try and do your will to the best of my ability today. I said a while ago, that lasts a little while. Usually until I get in the car and start driving to work and somebody cuts in front of me. But you know, if we're trying to live this program, there are certain little things that happen to us that will jerk us back to earth. And we know deep in here when we're not doing the right thing. I have to start all over. But thank God I can start all over at any time during the day. I can start a 24-hour period any time. And then at night, the last thing I do is I take my beautiful 10th step in the Serenity Prayer. And between the two of them, I go over my past 24 hours of living and take an inventory of what I've done. I think that's necessary for me to determine whether or not I've made any growth today. Because you and I can't stand still. We've got to grow a little bit. Ever so little, as long as we can recognize it, and the 10th step is put there for us to be able to measure this growth. But I need to look at it and say, have I misused the members of AA today? Have I misused the program? Have I had a sharp tongue? If I get a yes answer to either one of these three questions, I'd better back up and do something. And what about these mistakes you've made today, Jim? And there's always lots of them every day. Can you change any of these things? Or do you have to accept the things that your Lord told you? And Lord knows I need the wisdom to know the difference. And those that I can't accept, I can't change, I've got to go back to the people involved in these mistakes and try to somehow make amends. So every day I guess I hurt somebody in some way. See, I'm still an alcoholic. I'm prone to do these things. And I don't think the 12 steps meant that we were to stop hurting people when we came to AA. Because that's what the 10th step is there for. So we can continue to take this personal inventory of those we hurt, mistakes we make, and try to correct them by using the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I'm one that thinks if we forget to be grateful for what we have, pretty soon we may not have anything to be grateful for. All I think God expects of me is some form of recognition of this, and my recognition is merely saying, thank you, God. I don't have to tell him what for, because he knows, and he knows that I know. And I'm able to say, thank you, God, for this day. I can turn over and go to sleep, and most of the time sleep like a baby. I can't describe what this way of life is meant to me, what you've given me. But let me try to state it this way, and this is stealing something from the big book, but it pretty well describes how I feel. Because you care enough to share with me your experience, strength, and hope in love at all times, in great abundance with me, I have been projected into a fourth dimension of living, the likes of which I had never dreamed. And because of this, and because of you, I have tasted much of heaven. I love you.
Thank you, Jim. I enjoyed it. I'm not going to tell you that I'm speaking for the people here. It's not necessary. It's a privilege to be associated with people like you. I didn't read that either. I'm hunting something to read now, because Lillian put all this stuff down here for me, and announcements. If not, that's all for me. If not, we have no dues or fees
But we do have expenses. And if anybody's sitting on his billfold and can't get to it, it's all right if you want to stand up. And all you good people. One announcement I would like to make. On your schedule, Bob announced this, but if you have a schedule of activities and think you know what time the meeting's going to be in the morning, you don't. It didn't print. Sunday morning, September 20th at 9:30. And we request everybody to be here on time, please. Now, I want to thank all of you for giving me the privilege of being here tonight. And we'll close the meeting. Those of you who wish, please stand and recite with me the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.